Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
With conversations about race so fraught right now, there's a new novel that took some daring to publish. It's called The Sellout by Paul Beatty, and critics are loving it. It's a satire told by a narrator named Bon Bon, a young black man who grows up isolated in Southern California and winds up in a race trial at the Supreme Court. Along the way, he enslaves an old friend and resegregates the local high school. Steve Paulson asked Beatty to read a passage from the prologue.
Uncomfortable with being so comfortable, I make one last attempt to be at one with my people. I close my eyes, place my head on the table, and bury my broad nose in the crook of my arm. I cull through my vast repository of daydream blackness until I dredge up the scratchy archival footage of the civil rights struggle. Handling it carefully by its sensitive edges, I remove it from its sacred canister. I flip on the projector. There's no need to focus. Human carnage is always filmed and remembered in the highest definition. That incessant Black History Month loop of barking dogs, gushing fire hoses, and carbuncles oozing blood from $2 haircuts. These are the pictures that form our collective 16mm superego. But today I can't concentrate. The film inside my head begins to skip and sputter. The sound cuts out and protesters falling like dominoes in Selma, Alabama, begin to look like Keystone Negroes slipping en masse on an affirmative action banana peel. The marchers on Washington become civil rights zombies, 100,000 strong. The head zombie looks exhausted from being raised from the dead every time someone wants to make a point about what black people should and shouldn't do, can and cannot have. He doesn't know the mic is on. And under his breath, he confesses that if only he'd tasted that unsweetened swill that passed for iced tea at the segregated lunch counters in the South, he would have called the whole civil rights thing off. Still, I don't feel guilty. If I'm indeed moving backward and dragging all of Black America down with me, I couldn't care less. Is it my fault that the only tangible benefit to come out of the civil rights movement is that Black people aren't afraid of dogs as they used to be? No, it isn't.
Wow. So one of the things your narrator, Bon Bon, is doing is he sort of bristles at the expectations that are often laid out for Black people. Mm. I'm guessing you share that reluctance to embrace some of these expectations.
Oh, that'd be a guess. But I mean, it's a book and some of the things I agree with, some things I don't. That part is, I think, accurate with the protagonist.
Yeah. Now, one of the bizarre twists in this story is that Bon Bon ends up owning a slave. And we should point out, I mean, this is a story that is set in our contemporary world. Mm. How does this happen?
Oh, he has an encounter with a resident in his neighborhood named Hominy Jenkins, who's the last living little rascal and has the catchphrase, yowza.
Little Rascals from the old TV show.
Exactly. And he was Buckwheat's understudy. If you're familiar with the Little Rascals, especially the black male characters, they kind of introduce them really young and groom them to take over for Stymie or Farina, whoever. So he was next in line. The Little Rascals kind of ended before he got his real chance to shine. So he's a little bitter about that. And the protagonist kind of ends up saving his life. And Bon Bon's used to, like, living his life through these really old movie kind of tropes and, you know, feels a sense of debt to him a little bit. And I think in the back of his head realized he can be of some help.
But why would Hominy Jenkins want to be a slave?
He's had a whole career of playing slaves and pool boys and cabin boys and these kind of roles. He's a little crazy.
It's just so outlandish. An old guy who volunteers to be a slave and, you know, sort of talks to one of his friends into being his slave master?
I mean, it depends how you want to think about it. I mean, is slavery outlandish? No, I mean, there are still slaves today around the world. I remember being in college and having this debate a long time ago. This one guy was saying, no, people have a right to be slaves if they want to be slaves. And I just remember my friend being really upset about that. But it was a conversation that stuck with me at some level.
Hmm. Well, there's another point in your book, The Sellout, where Bon Bon decides to resegregate the school system in his hometown of Dickens, which is on the southern outskirts of Los Angeles. Why does he want to do this?
I think part of the thing is it's easy to look at the book and there's a lawn jockey on the cover, and you've been talking about slavery. We're getting ready to have a little conversation about segregation. And the idea is these words aren't what they are necessarily in the book. These words don't have the exact same meaning that they have in the way that we encounter them in history class or wherever we encounter them, dinner table, whatever. And so when he sets out to segregate the school, he's already kind of segregated this one bus on a single bus line, and it's kind of been effective in a weird way. And that has brought a certain calm to at least that bus. The school is already segregated. It's already all kids of color, mostly Latino and Black. So he's got this idea of, you know, what's the power of segregation? What happens when people feel like they're being judged and being isolated for a purpose, for a reason, not a good one? And so he just wants to just put the label on what's really happening. But that was part of the fun for me was like, how do you segregate something that's already segregated? You know, how do you put that pressure on somebody? Charisma. I thought of a way to get the kids to behave and respect each other like they do on the bus. How? Segregate the school. As soon as I said it, I realized that segregation would be the key to bringing Dickens back. The communal feeling of the bus would spread to the school and then permeate the rest of the city. Apartheid, united Black South Africa. Why couldn't they do the same for Dickens? By race? You want to segregate the school by color? Charisma looked at me like I was one of her students. Not stupid, but clueless. If you ask me, Chaff Middle School had already been segregated and resegregated many times over. Maybe not by color, but certainly by reading level and by behavior problem. The English as a second language speakers were on a different learning track than the English when and only if I feel like it speakers. During Black History Month, my father used to watch the nightly television footage of the freedom buses burning, the dogs snarling and snapping, and say to me, "You can't force integration, boy. The people who want to integrate will integrate." I've never figured out to what extent, if at all, I agree or disagree with him, but it's an observation that stayed with me, made me realize that for many people, integration is a finite concept. Here in America, integration can be a cover-up. I'm not racist. My prom date, second cousin, my president is Black, or whatever.
Going back to an earlier book you did, Hokum, an anthology of African-American humor, you wrote about your introduction to Black literature as a kid when you were assigned Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. And the way you write about it, you didn't much like that book.
Oh, I didn't give it much of a chance either. So I just remember reading it and just questioning, like, why are they sending me this? Like, what is this message here? I know why. You know, I went to an all-Black, for the most part, like 95% Black, I guess, junior high school. You know, they send like a certain segment of the kids this book. Started reading it, and I was just like, I'm already living this terrible life. Like, why are they just reinforcing this on me? It was so uncomfortable. It struck me as a weird message, and it's just something that stayed with me. And, you know, I was really young at the time.
Well, I guess I'm wondering, you know, even when you were a kid, when you were in junior high, whether part of what you were reacting at was, this is what you're supposed to get by reading, quote, Black literature, an author like Maya Angelou or Richard Wright or James Baldwin. And I'm wondering if partly what you were reacting against was kind of this earnestness in some of these books.
That could have been some of it, I guess. Some of it was just I reacted to a lot of things like that. I remember we were supposed to read The Hobbit. I never read The Hobbit either because I felt that was silly. A lot of it's just my personality.
Well, I mean, most people, when they read your novels or, you know, going back to this anthology of humor that you put together, they would describe you as working within the tradition of satire. Is that a good way to sort of frame your literary sensibility?
I would never use that word. So I never say, I don't think of it, but somebody's going to prove me wrong or something. So I've never said I'm a satirist or anything like that. I'm not saying that it's not that stuff, but it's not how I think of my work. I just write. Is it satirical? Yeah, sure it is. But I just don't see myself that way, really. I can't help but tell jokes and they make fun of stuff.
I want to ask you about the recent review that Dwight Garner had in the New York Times. Very laudatory. It says your novel reads like the most concussive monologues and interviews of Chris Rock, Richard Pryor, and Dave Chappelle. You know, he's citing stand-up comics. Do you see yourself as kind of, I don't know, working in that tradition, influenced by stand-up comedy?
I don't really like stand-up comedy, apart from maybe Richard Pryor. Those are three guys who I like and I think are really funny. I don't see myself in their tradition, really. But Richard Pryor was definitely a huge, huge... Him and Kurt Vonnegut are probably two people that... It's not like I think about them, but, you know, reading them and listening to Richard Pryor just so enjoyable for me. So it's not like I'm trying to emulate them.
But there was something about their voices that
responded to. Yeah, it's definitely in my bones. Yeah, no doubt.
Paul Beatty talking with Steve Paulson. Beatty's novel is called The Sellout.